artística, ecco.
Thank you for the kind introduction, and the chance to speak here. So, here's an outline. So basically what I'll be talking about is some of the solutions of the problem with the standard model that are described by the idea. So just for completeness, I'll review some of the problems with the standard model and tell you a bit about causal set idea, classical sequential growth, and then on to the main part of my talk, that will be causal set solution to the lambda problem, cosmological constant problem. And maybe I'll say some word words about the horizon problem, or the negative horizon problem as well. Then I'll conclude with some remarks. Okay. So if you believe that GR describes gravity, say to a certain Lefort scale, and cosmological principle holds, and if you apply certain initial conditions, appropriate initial conditions, now what you get is the standard model, and there are these three big successes of the standard model that everybody knows about, nuclear synthesis, CLB, and the expansion of the universe. These are the three classical pillars of standard model. And then, of course, standard model also allows for the evolution of density perturbations, which are generated somewhere in the universe, and result in the structure formation, and which is a necessary thing for any successful theory of cosmology, that it should allow for the evolution of these perturbations. Having said that, there are some puzzles slash challenges slash problems with the standard model. The first one is that the standard model does not tell you where does the universe come from. In fact, if you believe that the GR is good to something like t is equal to zero, then you're left with a singularity and you don't know where to go from it. You don't know how to handle the singularity. The next one is the so-called horizon problem, which is the statement of the fact that the, say, cosmic microwave background, when it was released, it came from about 100,000 causally disjoint regions. And now when you measure the temperature of cosmic microwave background, it's the same everywhere. The fluctuations are being of the order of 10 to the 10 to the minus 5. Then next is the flatness problem, which points to the incredible fine tuning that you have to do of the initial energy density in the early universe for the universe to come out bright at late times. Then arguably the hottest problem in cosmology, maybe GR as well, why is the cosmological constant zero, or why is the... Now there are two problems here, so, okay. So if you believe that the GR is only good up to a scale, certain cutoff scale, and that scale is around Planck length, then this lambda, which is zero, is about 120 orders of magnitude smaller than its natural value. Now if you come from behind and say that, well, there is a symmetry in some fundamental theory that that is yet unknown, and that sets the cosmological constant to zero, then you're faced with another problem, then why is that zero not an exact zero? Well, why is there is this small cosmological constant left over? Why is it comparable to critical density, for example, now? Then, of course, baryogenesis, did it happen, did it not happen, primordial fluctuations, origin, where did they come from, are they primordial or not, what is the nature of dark matter, and etc. So before I go on to speak about some of the problem to the solution to some of these problems from causal set theory, let me just say a few words about the causal set theory. So the causal set idea is that the at the most fundamental level, the universe is not described by a space-time. It's not a continuum. It's a discrete structure, and the discrete structure is given by a causal set. And what is a causal set? A causal set is a bunch of elements, and there are some of these elements, and not necessarily all of them, are related to each other. So it's a partially ordered set. And the precede relation, this relation that we call precede, satisfies these three properties. So it's irreflexive, meaning that no element can precede itself. If an element X precedes an element Y, then that element Y can precede another element Z only if X also precedes Z. It's transitive. And then it's locally finite. So if you take two elements and you take all the elements in between them, that the set has to be finite. So this relationship at the causal set level gives you the causal structure at the space-time level, and all the geometrical quantities like proper time, four volume, and they are now simple process of counting the causal set elements in a given region, for example. So most important are for this talk the four volume and the proper time. Okay. So that's not good.
I think we can see.
You can see it? Okay, so for example, if you want to find the floor volume of this region, all you have to do is count the number of elements in the region. And if you want to find out the proper time between these two points, you have to find the longest chain that connects them and count the number of links. Okay? So yesterday we were trying it out and we didn't put a piece of paper.
Yeah, if you change the light to come from the top, then it'll work.
Yes, I think so.
Oh, yeah.
But I keep changing back and forth. Is there a button that just lets me keep changing back and forth?
Yeah, there's a lamp button on the front thing.
But you can put paper under all your slides, so.
No, I just want the bottom light to go away when I put the paper.
Yeah. I've been saying you could always put a black and white sheet of paper there.
That's.
No.
And now turn on the.
Yeah.
Yeah. Turn on the top.
Turn on the
top.
Okay, that doesn't. Halfway there.
Try it again and see what happens next.
Just keep pushing it.
Oh, yeah, it's a bit.
Okay, so I have to push back. Okay.
And then you can lay the transparency on top of the opaque white piece of paper.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It works. Let's see. It's okay.
Everybody.
Yeah.
Is it
okay.
Yeah,
there's a
you can probably adjust the maps.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So is this good? Okay. So basically, V is equal to N, and tau is equal to L, and they're proportional. So how do you grow causal sets? So here is a partially ordered set of causal sets. So it's a causal set of causal sets. And unless we again, if we change the name, it used to be called postcard. Still called postcard?
I'm sorry. No one came up with a better name.
Yeah. Because we're trying to think of names for it.
Yes.
So this is one element problem set, this is two element problem set, these are two element problem set, three element problem set, and so on and so forth. So there's a recipe for growing causal sets called classical sequential growth. And what it does is that it tells you how to take an n element causal set and attach another element to it. So how to go from n element causal set to n plus one element causal set. So it's a stochastic process and it assigns probabilities for going from n element causal set to n plus one element causal set based on these three criteria. So there is interim temporality, means that if you have an existing causal set and you want to add one more element, you cannot add that element to the past of any existing element. So there is discrete general covariance, meaning that as the elements come into being, you can label them by the order of their birth, but that order does not play any role in the physics of causal sets. So if you want to get to causal set, the way you get to the causal set does not matter. Then there is Bell causality, which means that all the elements that are space-like to a transition, they do not affect the relative probabilities of the transition. So if you take the ratio of the transition probabilities, they do not affect the transition. Anyway, so so let's come to the causal set solution. To the cosmological constant problem. Okay, so these are the three ingredients. These are the three ingredients for the solution to the problem. So if your theory allows for local finiteness, and I've already explained what that means, and it makes lambda and b cosmological constant for volume conjugate variables and gives you an uncertainty relationship between them, and if you know what your uncertainty in volume is, then you can actually predict the fluctuations in lambda. So causal set theory is a locally finite theory, but we do not have a quantum dynamics for causal set as yet. So this is an expectation of the quantum dynamics of causal sets that it'll make cosmological constant and four volume conjugate variables, and will give you an uncertainty principle like this. But I should say that this should be an expectation of any theory of quantum gravity, that to the extent that these two variables are defined in the theory, you should get an uncertainty relationship like this between the two variables. And this is something that is very particular to quantum set theory. Now the relationship between the correspondence between a causal set and a space-time that sort of approximates the causal set comes via a notion of percolation, which means that you take the region of the space-time, and if you want to see which causal set approximates space-time, or which causal set does the space-time most likely came from, then you sprinkle elements into that region, okay? And you can't do this with uniform density if you want the theory to be Lorentz invariant, okay? So you have to sprinkle with Poisson distribution, which means that if you know the number of elements in a given region, the volume of that region is not certain, is uncertain up to this number, which means that if there are n elements there, the volume of the space-time region is not v, but v plus minus square root of n, or v plus minus square root of v. Okay, so you know exactly what uncertainty in your volume there is, and so the fluctuations in lambda are straightforwardly calculated, and they are 1 over square root of v, and leaving detail aside, if you take the observable universe, the volume of the observable universe to be Hubble length to the 4, then we can actually show that the so yeah, there is this whole thing on the back of it that I haven't mentioned. So you can think of this as the action of the free space-time that without any matter or anything, just by virtue of its distance per unit for volume. That's the definition of action of the free space, gravitational action of the free space per unit for volume. Or in quantum set terms, this is the action per unit element, per element.
The delta V that you described, it's a kinematical fluctuation,
right?
Mm-hmm. Right? In the correspondence between the causal set and the continuous. But that delta V, delta lambda relation is a quantum.
Yeah. Right.
There's a quantum expectation. So why is that delta V the same as, why are those two delta Vs the same delta Vs?
Well, this form, this V is the full volume, right? So if you want to find the full volume of a region, you count the number of elements in it. But that does not give you exactly the volume, sort of. I don't see the question again.
Well, the delta V, which is twiddles plus or minus root n, that you can write down, just it's just a kinematic effect, it has nothing to do with quantum mechanics.
Right.
Right.
Right, it could come from quantum mechanics. It doesn't have to, but like radioactive element, its expectation value for how many constants you have, that's of course a quantum expectation value, but that obviates that boson statistics, right?
I suppose you could just say, I mean, in this context, if the uncertainty is coming from this causal set, then doesn't it just mean no matter how well you measure the volume,
right,
you put in the effective volume, you could never get better than that? It's something like the minimal uncertainty you could ever get. So that means, you know, it is the appropriate thing to put into the quantum uncertainty knowledge. You know, if you measured it, then that's the best measurement you could make. So what's the most accurate measurement of the cosmological constant you can make? And yeah, the only thing that puzzles me about it is why isn't then the cosmological constant actually uncertain? Or like, what would that mean? And it seems like then that we haven't got to that part.
When we find this uncertain principle, like this is a principle of a few
different. Right, so we don't have quantum dynamics yet, so this is an expectation of the dynamics. So you can make some arguments, I know arguments that motivate this, but right now it's just an expectation.
So it's not an actual theory, it's just.
Yeah, this is all heuristic
right
reasoning. I mean, there is. This sort of core, I mean, I think the way in which you can see best why you would expect this conjugacy between lambda and v, or perhaps the very simplest way to see it is just look at the Lagrangian, you have lambda, I mean, look at the action, it's lambda integral dv, which is when you do the integral lambda v. So that's a term, that looks like a term of conjugate variables, like E and T in the action. But the more sophisticated is to do the univariate formulation of gravity, in which lambda becomes a variable, a dynamical variable. There's a dynamical variable that represents volume to the past of the surface. And you work out all the canonical commutation directions. And again, you see this relationship.
Yeah, so this is all the heuristic. And okay, so in order to put this on a computer, we not just straightforward to put it on the computer, so we had to put up a model to mimic these fluctuations, and then several interpretations, and so there are complications, other complications that I'm not mentioning yet, but I just want to show this because the there are two things that I'm talking about, so one thing is time. So this is the simulation of a universe that contains matter, radiation, matter properties, fluctuations in lambda. So this is lambda fluctuating lambda term parameter in there. And the simulations show that and this is the generic behavior. That the energy density in cosmological constant, the fluctuating cosmological constant, always tracks the dominant part of the energy density. So when radiation runs dominant, it tracks radiation. When matter becomes dominant, the energy density in fluctuating lambda stops tracking radiation and starts tracking matter. So it gives you a tracking model. Okay. So which also sort of answers the why now. Puzzle as to why is it that the cosmological constant is becoming dominant now. The fluctuation in the cosmological constant has always been there. It's just that Oh, by the way, there's one more thing that I should have said, is that the, so these are fluctuations about a mean, and you're taking the mean to be zero. So I, so there is no explanation for why the mean is zero, and you're assuming for something that, so in this simulation, the mean of the lambda is taken to be zero. So it's just the fluctuations around that mean.
Does it fluctuate with time, or is it just a, and like each other steps, or what's the scale of what's required with time?
So it is fluctuating in time, yes. So this depends. So this question is actually what model are we using for the fluctuations? How does it fluctuate inside and things like that? So what the model that we use was that each element is born, it contributes something to the action, and then you divide the action by the number of elements that gives you the effective value of lambda at that time. So as each element is born, it either, let's say, it contributes plus one or minus one to the action. So it sort of fluctuates in the same kind of fluctuation that we make.
I guess what's the steps? Because the step size either in the causal set element or in time.
In principle, the step size is one causal set element. But of course, that will take about 10 minutes from 48 to somewhere. So you plot that together.
Okay, but
just to make sure that.
Like when lambda becomes like this value, how long does it take another info to go to zero or
then? Right. So I'm not sure if we have info in zero.
I think it's travel trace about the Hubble time.
So there is this correlation. So if you take two elements and you want to see how much, what is the correlation between the two, between the value of lambda at 2 points, you take their paths and whatever the overlap of the paths is, that's the correlation. So if you change the path by a factor of 2, then the correlation goes down by a factor of 2.
Typically, it's about a Hubble. I mean, it's about you didn't say also, I mean, there's a weakness in this model, as we did in there, which is that we just assume spatial homogeneity. So the only questions about the spatial inhomogeneity or correlations of the effect of them to different spatial points are not answered, or rather they're answered by fiat. So only temporal fluctuations are put in. That was because, well, you could explain why we felt it necessary to do that, to make the model, but maybe you don't want to.
Right. I mean, we can come back to it in question time. Now, the most popular value for the fraction of energy density in cosmological particles, according to the literature, is 0.7. And we wanted to see if we could match that. So since I want the probabilistic model, all we can do is calculate the probabilities, and we calculate the probabilities by plotting these histograms. So these are the, so we do different runs of the universe, and every time we get to the final time, we record the value of omega lambda, and we plot that, and you can see that in 4 to 5% of the runs, we get close to about 0.7. So this does not only give you a tracking model, but also has the potential of a sort of for the current observation constraints, but of course there are weaknesses as
right now.
These are different. So you run a simulation of the universe, and whatever omega lambda that you get at the end of the simulation, you record it, and then 200 or 300 simulations later, histogram. So these are. This is how the. Are the final values of omega lambda in this simulation are distributed.
Mostly around 0.2?
So the mostly around 0.0.
All right.
So it's not very likely to get 0.7.
Yeah, 45%.
45%.
Okay, let's go on to a version of the horizon problems, or really speaking, why the universe or the universe in causal context is so large but it's not so old. So the intuitive solution is that there's a phase of exponential expansion in the universe. which is caused by the scalar field, or by our scalar field. Now the condenser idea comes from some of these models in classical sequential growth that have these structures that we call posts. So a post is a is an element such that the rest of the condenser either to the future of it or to the past of it. So it's like a big crunch or a big bang. Okay. So if you take the universe right after the post, it's like your universe. And so some of the interesting properties of these models are that they give you, right after the post, they give you an exponential expansion. They give you something like a random tree. I'll talk more about it in a minute. And then that phase is followed by a decentralized expansion. This is the work in progress, and I'm doing this with David. So let's say a bit more about it. So one of these models that have these posts is transitive percolation. So the probability in classical sequential growth in going from n element column set to an n plus 1 element column set depends on these coupling constants. And we have introduced one per state, I guess. And if these coupling constants have this sort of formula, where p is a problem, I'll talk more about p, then this is called transitive percolation. Now, leaving detail aside, you can think of this p as the probability that a newborn element would choose a parent. Okay. So how do you grow an element, or for example, a simple way of growing a causal set via percolation would be to, so you have an existing causal set, so you take a new element and you go to each other element, okay, and you ask the question whether you want to be the parent of this newborn. And you ask the question whether you want to be dependent on this newborn, and the answer is yes with probability p and no with probability 1 minus p. Okay? So that's how you grow. Now if p is very, very, very small, like 10 to the minus 20 or something, then the structure that you get is you go to one, if you have one element called such, you go and ask, do you want to be the parent of the next term? You say no. Then this keeps on happening and happening and happening, and nobody is adopting a child, so it's a long anti-chain, and everything is based like you. Now, our universe is not like that, okay? So, what do you do? Well, just like you do with this universe, you force each element to have a parent. Okay?
That's not like...
You can have more than one, but at least one parent. Okay, but still, since you're forcing it, at most what they're going to take is one parent. Okay, so you get something like a tree, a random tree. Okay, so this is a structure like this. I've got a picture that I made actually nearly most of our work. So this is a post, okay, and this is the tree region. And then after that, you get somewhere up there, and you get the desired region. So we also made another picture for the same concept where you can actually see the tree region. You can see the colors.
Okay. If you raise the lights.
Yeah. Is it better than transparent?
Yeah, transparency starts reflecting with the paper, doesn't it? Anyway, so all these black elements are part of the random tree, and then there is another. So since this is the sort of the limitation of the plotting program, that it does not let you plot very many elements. So here is one which is a very small causal set, and in this one you can actually see this region here, which is the tree. So these all blacks are tree region, and these reds are part of the
serial region. So the tree region, everybody has only one parent. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. But above that, then you
can have. Yeah, they can have more ancestors, but they have just one parent.
Yeah, but they have only one parent. But above that, they have more than one.
Right.
So you don't change the piece, the same piece as the group. Which is,
which no, you don't change the piece. Yeah. You don't change the piece. So this is the cut. This is the portion of the last one that is shown.
It's a different one.
It's a different one. Okay. So anyway, so this is these. Okay. Since I can't see the colors. Okay. So
some are black and some are red.
Yes.
Yeah. So the black ones are part of the tree. So they have only one parent. And then this is the receiver region. So there is this expansion. And then
this
expansion. Yes.
This is bigger.
This is bigger.
I think it expanded the sitter because the first time you mentioned the sitter.
I'll talk more about it. This,
you said you force each element to have a parent. I mean, that's right, quite right. I mean, in transitive percolation, you necessarily get posts.
Right.
I mean, transitive percolation just has, you're not forcing, you just have your parameter P, and it has this rule that each element chooses an already existing element to be a parent with probability P,
yeah.
Right? And that's the rule. And you always get posts in that, in such a time. If you run that dynamics, you always get,
right,
at least, you know, you'll get a post, you'll get infinitely many posts. And then the structure of the causal set after the post is tree-like, right?
Right.
So there's no forcing there.
Right.
Not, you know, in transitive percolation,
yeah,
it's by itself gives you this.
Yeah, but if we do this with a finite number of elements on a computer, you can't generate.
In the simulation, you
force. In the simulation, you force.
Right.
But,
right.
I don't know, people might get the impression that you're putting in this tree and then you're making
right
it do. You're not, I mean, it's not like that, though.
It's
transitive, yeah, the transitive percolation creates this tree-like structure after each post. So
right,
just that rule. You don't need to.
You get that structure back,
yeah,
you have to force it.
Yeah, to create that on the computer, you have to.
Well, but
in other words, I mean, if you were to do it on the computer, naturally you'd have to run the computer even longer than what you mentioned before, exponentially longer, probably. So you're trying to zero in on a region where there really is a post, but that's well, you know, you can't start from the big, from zero and get to that region by simulation. But you understand theoretically that if you wanted to make a good simulation of that region, the way to do it is to force
the
So does it mean that it's like a many universe model because you have many posts, you have like many big claims?
It's a bouncing universe, not
yeah,
immense.
It's a secret bouncing.
Posts are one after
each. Yeah, one after the other, right?
Well, you could have many posts.
They're not improbable in this model.
First of all, you can't have the definition of post, but that's that's not a real answer. Yeah, I guess the real answer, I don't know. I guess the real answer would be that those are much less likely than sequential posts.
I don't
know.
Is that the definition of originary that you somehow dropped?
Okay, branch to like post.
Yeah, but then you don't have.
Nyayas is saying, I guess you could form something where there were two elements,
mm-hmm,
such everything was still there to the past of each of them, I think.
Yeah.
But then
yeah,
in the future, everything was either to the future of this one
right
or to the future of this
yeah
one for a very long time.
Yeah. Yeah. You could generate.
That would be very unlikely in most of the CSG models. I think it would be much, much less likely than
yeah
kind of
it's not ordinary.
It's not impossible. It's not.
But you can imagine there's nothing really to force all of the relations to go to one or the other.
Yeah.
So it's sort of just entropically.
I thought you somehow dropped those that don't have. So you start from.
Well, that's what Faye's point was. So that's just, that's a rule of the simulation, but it's something that is naturally produced by the dynamics.
Mm-hmm. If you imagine.
And the point is that you could. The point is, if you could imagine doing a simulator, running the dynamics for long enough, something would form that looks like a post, and then you'd say, "Oh, but after all, it's not a post because some other things would form that didn't have this other.
You'd have to bake in 50 dollars.
So it'd be like a would-be post, and then it failed, and then another one would form. But if you waited long enough, then a genuine post would form. And then if you ask for the structure, typical structure of the puzzle set, after that forms, then you get it by the simulations where you force everything to have it as parents.
So this thing has some very nice possible input features. For example, it's homogeneous, meaning that every element has the same sort of neighborhood, the elements that are connected to or future light cone of the past light. So it's everything about the same, up to random fluctuations. And due to these random fluctuations, by the way, it appears inhomogeneous in time. So there are these posts that sort of appear. And so the universe had these big crunches and big bangs. And every time you have this big bang, the universe will disappear. And you can actually get any side of the universe. All you have to do have is a small enough p. By the way, this is not fine-tuning, because there's something like cosmic renormalization that I haven't mentioned, which means that if you start with any generic model of classical sequential growth, and if you have posts, then you, after every post, you sort of renormalize your p so that it becomes smaller, and the size of the universe gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So you can have any size of the universe. All you have to do is just pay long enough. So it's sort of not a fine tuning of this parameter. So
what do you mean by size?
Size means the size means sort of this thing.
Right, but what is large?
1 over p. But that's the longest, biggest anti-chain that you can get.
The anti-chains are things that are not related causally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're not related causally, right?
So the analog of the spatial slice.
Right.
Yeah, it's like the largest volume of any spatial slice. In that effort.
Yeah. So, and why did I say that we get a phase that we have by the center, so the early universe of classical sequential growth has far too few elements to look anything like a space-time yet, but there is this correspondence, and so we can always look at the dependence of this on this and compare it to the dependence of this on this. Okay, so what you do is you grow a column set, your original population, and then you leave out the tree region. And after that, you can, for any two elements that are related to each other, you calculate the number of elements that are related to both of them. And you also find the length of the longest chain that connects them. And then, of course, you plot them, and then you try to fill it with these two functions, which are for the center. So this is the volume of an Alexandrov neighborhood in the center space time as a function of the proper time. Okay, so
D is the space time dimension.
Right.
Mm.
D is
or
the spatial dimension.
D is the spatial
dimension. Yes. So this is one of the results for P is equal to 2 times 10 to the minus 4, and n is equal to 30,000. By the way, so this is n max. N max meaning that for each value of n, you choose the maximum value of n. Because this is for most space time like. So.
Can you say that again, Michael?
So for each value of n, so. So there are for each, okay, so how do we get this N diamond and L?
You said that you chose 2 points, calculate
right.
The number
that's
of elements between them.
So we take these 2 points, we calculate all the elements that are related to both of these. You calculate the length of the longest chain, okay? And you do this for all these elements. So many elements will have the same L, but different N. Right? So what you do is that you choose the maximum n. You can also take the average of the n as well.
Is this a real, is this a sprinkling into? It's not an actual.
I just stole this from
those. It is a real sprinkling.
Yeah.
No, but this is in Karski's paper. Right?
It is in Karski's paper.
Right.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting how far it deviates from the sentence.
That's the longest chain in that.
Those are all the longest chains.
Funny, they're all over
there.
Why are they all on that side? Why is there a big sort of chunk of them in the middle?
Right.
Because there's a high density region.
Why it's a landon, so that's why.
There's some concentration
of elements and it all attracts. Interesting.
Interesting.
Random things are really surprising.
Yes, that's right. And then quantum mechanics.
Okay, so this is. So, by the way, these values are parameters.
So, you plotted this maximum. So, you choose all the pairs with the same L,
right.
And you plot the maximum
right.
N. But you have error bars.
Yes, over the simulation, you take different Ns, right? It's different and maximum, that's what you get, where you get these.
Well, we did a number of different simulations.
Why don't you why aren't the error bars just all the n's for each L? Why don't you do that? So fix the sprinkling for each L.
For a given sprinkling, you won't have the error bars.
So you're saying, why don't you just plot the mean?
Yeah, you could plot
the mean.
And then
the error bars.
And then sigma and the error bars.
It had arguments. I would agree with you.
We did that as well.
Yeah, we did that.
But is it different from that?
Do you have this?
Do you get a different?
No, I don't have this. It still would give you the same.
I think this is purely opportunistic. Right? It looks nicer if you do it this way. Do you have another?
When you use a T-shirt, it's shown in the paper.
So the other way, it doesn't track this thing so well, or it doesn't?
Not quite as well.
Yeah, not quite as well.
This is just the sitter, right? But the curve that goes through.
Right.
Yes.
This is the
continuum.
Sitter.
3+1
the sitter. 3+1
And it's 3+1, and you did not put 3+1 in your causal set anyway.
No.
It's just one parameter p.
Right.
Well, n.
Yes.
Two
in fact, this is
3+1.
In fact, this is not relevant. This is the relevant.
So, what does the curve for 2+1 look like? Continuum curve for 2+1. Where is that?
We didn't plot.
Yeah,
so
but how well is it? How close is it?
Is this P?
How close is the 2+1 curve to that curve?
Also, is this P, you didn't have to tune anything to get it to look like 3+1 to 6, is that what you're saying? This P doesn't matter.
This is sort of the
you didn't have to tune anything.
Best chi-square.
No, we didn't tune P, there's two fit parameters that we used as a function.
Yes.
So that's what if you use 0.001 and stuff.
Yeah, how stable is it?
Yeah, that's what I
mean. I think for a given range of P, it is somewhat stable, yeah.
Oh. So you're saying there's no, when you run the CSG model, which didn't have anything to do with 3+1, and this comes out to match that better than the other.
So the different
P's
you mentioned.
Yes, if you choose. So we can't go very small. The smallest that we have done is 10 to the minus 4. 10 to the minus 4. 10 to the minus 4 with 50,000 elements, and that still gives you 3%. But you can get smaller dimensions by choosing bigger P's. So,
bigger
ones do give you the better fit to say
2+1.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yes.
Looking
at a very tiny universe.
Yeah, very tiny universe, of course.
Well, one thing was that if we do a mean n rather than a maximum n, you get a different dimension, I think.
No, I think we checked that.
Well,
but the fit is not as good. Yeah. And sort of it was intuitive. I mean, if you add in a lot of just straight intervals in there, like the very skinny ones, of course it's not going to look like this in our shadow. So you have to take the biggest one in comparison. But that's a good point. I mean, the best argument against using n max is that this goes to infinity as n goes to infinity. Maybe if you use a cutoff somewhere, you haven't introduced any cutoff. But the average does not go to infinity as n goes to infinity. So.
So the skinny intervals are just ones with small.
Small volume for
small
volume. For given out.
Small volume.
So you attribute those to fluctuations that
right.
would go away if you
yeah. effect of discrete.
And the part of the end where it does not match.
Yeah. So this is where
it's a new finite.
Yeah, the finite. Yeah. So it sort of sees the.
It's easy to come back to.
Can't exactly come back to.
I'd like to see the 2 plus 1 curve.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I have another one with 3 plus 1, which is this.
Well, what is that?
Point
this is
yeah, this is 0.02 and 3 times.
So you can go it from the whole decade, from my
point.
Point.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it's all 3 plus 1.
But it's really just the one part where you were saying that the 3 part just where there's a transition. It's the whole line is just a decision. It doesn't depend on the dimension there.
Oh.
The linear part. It's just where you make the transition.
Oh,
right. That's you see the dependent on dimension, right?
Right.
So that small knee, that's where you just
read
out the dimension.
So if we tried to fit with 5 plus 1 or something, the straight part would still fit well, but the knee would not.
So what happens is that
I
think it just leaves these out and sort of goes like this. And, I mean, it systematically misses these from below or and this is the form of one or something like this.
If you use the wrong direction.
Right. You use the wrong direction. And the other thing is that I didn't mention as there is a saying that there are these, so n is equal to tau is equal to ml. So the value of n, so this is a free parameter. So this is the proper time, and this is the longest chain. And so m is a fitting parameter, and its value comes out to be about 2, which is this, which is exactly what it is in Minkowski space.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it comes out 2 point sometimes.
It's not exactly.
Plus minus point.
It's exact, but in the two-dimensional Minkowski space,
it's
exact.
Yeah.
But it has a somewhat different value in 4 dimensions.
Is
so
it
known on
the 16-4, or is it just simulations?
Just by simulation. But it's not to a good accuracy. 2 or 3 decimal places.
How do we know that? What do you mean? I don't quite understand. So how can you calculate m from Minkowski?
So you sprinkle elements and you check length of longest chains, and you know what the proper time is, and from there you can get the ready.
Ah, okay.
In two dimensions, that's you can prove analytically. It's in the limit of infinite density spin. Right. You can prove
what this number is. You don't have to rely on this simulation. You can't do such an analytic. You can't identify this number analytically. Just this. I mean, this M is really a fudge factor that transforms between volume information and length information. So if you normalize things so that each element corresponds to a volume of 1.
Yeah.
Then you
but there is volume in there, that's just tau and tau.
Well, volume has some L to it.
This N is not the factor?
Some
it's the same L.
Yes,
N 4 to the N. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. This.
Mm.
Yeah, so if you take this like region of the galaxy space and you say it has a certain volume, right? And then if you say that the number of elements should equal the volume, then that fixes the normalization. I mean, that fixes the right answer. Yeah. And then you can ask, well, now take the longest chain, how does that compare to the length from the time?
Okay.
And it won't be strictly equal anymore. There'll be something of order unity debating, and that's the time.
And that's always the order two?
It's always the order one, yeah. I mean, it's there's a two somewhere. There's a two that comes in somehow.
There are even more other simulations for the cosmological constant. This is around two, I guess.
Is it?
You can't go much below that. It's actually 1/3 or something. 1/3. Okay, so let me summarize. So classical sequential growth is a very simple model. Yes, it's a very clear and philosophically very satisfying principles of these general covariance and that. It has many desirable properties of the cosmological model, and maybe solve some problems that are one of them. For example, now you know what happens before the beginning, and the initial singularities are a problem anymore because of the discreteness. You have these shortly after Big Bang, you have this exponential growth, and then you enter into a decimal-like era where you emerge from there large and homogeneous. Then there is a natural explanation for the small non-zero value of cosmological constant. You also solve the Wien-Dahl problem. And what
you
things?
You don't solve the Wien-Dahl problem. You just raise the question.
See?
You're saying it's not now, it is.
Yeah. Right. So for the constant cosmological constant, there's no.
Yeah.
But there is a Wien-Dahl problem. Yes.
Which is
because the universe is accelerating now, the expansion is accelerating now, and it wasn't accelerating before.
Yeah, because the fluctuating took the lambda close to zero.
Yeah, so that's
it solves all these problems.
That's a probabilistic.
You're saying lambda actually dominates now. It's not the
But the thing is that what this scenario. Yeah, it's always, statistically, it's always the same fraction. In the past, in the radiation era, in matter, always. So in this model, that's what it is. It's always tracking. But what observations seem to indicate is that it wasn't never dominant, and it becomes dominant now. And I guess maybe the answer is that it's the statistical fluctuation, that it was always subdominant.
Right,
and
so
statistically, it's also.
It's just a falsifiable model, right? So if you don't see these fluctuations in time for a long period, then what's the stuff?
Yeah, it's a falsifiable model. The question is already falsified.
Yeah, that's something. Yeah, maybe it's already falsified.
But what are you claiming?
That's what Pepe was asking. Lenny. No, not Lenny. Your friend
Bruce.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that we're not seeing any indication that.
Are
you claiming that these percolation models in this in your Dissita region are actually manifold?
No. All I'm saying is that the behavior for n versus tau l looks about the same as the Dissita behavior of v versus tau.
So the universe that it yields is
many
desirable cosmological properties, but it has one very
understood.
It's not a manifold at all, right? So it's sort of
we know that the universe was that thing. Early universe, anyway. Now it is, yes. The early universe, and there was like 10 to 6 elements.
No.
But then this would be a model of pre-Big Bang, right? So
yes.
You would then the model is well. There's a post, then there's a tree-like growth,
right.
Then there's a sort of exponential kind of expansion, and then there's the era we call the Big Bang, after which it's manifold. Yeah.
And I think that transition is also not clear how it happens. Right. You have
somehow you want to end it, it's a
just
way.
Yeah.
Well, that almost certainly won't happen in these classical CLS chain
right.
Mm-hmm.
But is that the idea that this causal set, oh, this idea for a causal set solution of a horizon problem is that? Is the solution, is the putative solution that it sets an initial, that it's some pre Big Bang dynamics of,
right.
You know, in the quantum gravity era.
Yeah,
which then exit
right.
And you have set up the initial conditions
yeah.
For
exactly.
The
homogeneous
solution. Is that the concept?
Yes,
yeah,
that sounds good.
I
feel
that
would be the case, but
yeah.
I'm not sure if
we're
still there yet.
It is,
it's
a toy.
Yes.
Because
yeah,
I
think this
is
just indication. Yeah. I think the remarkable thing about the de Sitter is that, I mean, we have many reasons to believe that it cannot really make a transition, will not make a transition to a real nanoform. But the remarkable thing is how much it seems to be trying to do that.
Yeah.
We know it can't.
It means
we think we know
quantum
it can.
Help.
So then, but these models are only supposed to be considered like a stepping stone to some full quantum thing. They're more time models than classical limit.
Yeah. But these things written down here could be all true. This is a problem in which a lot of those things do happen.
So in this de Sitter light region, I think we know that there couldn't be anything like gravity, you know, propagating degrees of freedom. We know that sorts of things can't arise in from the CSG dynamic. But could it actually be manifold? Do we know that it's really not big enough?
We haven't proved. No one has proved that it's not manifold.
No one has proved it's not manifold.
But Graham is convinced absolutely that it's not manifold, right?
But it doesn't really matter, does it? Because
so it's not a sprinkling into it. One of your Alexandrov neighborhoods is not a sprinkling into an interval in distance.
No one has proved that.
No one has proved that, but Graham is convinced that.
Can you look in the simulations and check other variables, like check the dimension estimators and other things? And
Yes,
it could.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be a natural thing.
But that's not the part that we know experimentally to be a manifold, it's just the Minkowski part.
Mm-hmm.
If there is a Minkowski part, that we know it to be a manifold. So that's the part that's really more important, basically, empirically, right?
Yeah, but I think the important thing is that it was not full of that. This produces some things like large scale homogeneity. What it doesn't yet probably produce, as far as I know, is the right spectrum of fluctuations.
We have
something
some,
like a scale.
Yeah,
I don't know what the story is on the fluctuations.
We have some random fluctuations, but how to couple them?
Are they scale there?
Are
they
scale there? By the way, so just the last point. I mean, we don't need any fine-tuning. We don't need to fine-tune anything anymore.
You have a little fine-tuning in your lambda.
Yeah, we can't
sort
actually.
Of, yeah, you can't really get
to n is equal to 1.
Right.
Yeah.
A little.
No, it's
like
not
a factor of 2 or something.
Yeah, factor of 2. It's not 2.
If you do it in terms of
a number from
it's a factor of 50 or something.
Continuum.
I think the fourth word is a factor of 2.
So I have a question. Yes, I do.
But is lambda also, I think you mentioned this before, is it a largeness in space? Are you assuming that, or is it just, or is it
So the one that I showed you assumes spatial homogeneity.
Is that a fine tuning, or is it just an assumption?
This is just an assumption, because this is hard to simulate.
But you don't expect it.
This goes back to Gazzo's question. What does the lambda really mean? We don't know really what it means in the end of this heuristic argument. It's like to embed that in an actual concrete model, you have to give a lambda meaning. You have to give a meaning to the idea of a fluctuating lambda. that's not trivial, because if you just write down the answer equation with lambda, I mean, with lambda allowed to vary, then the Bianchi identity is proven that it doesn't vary. It has to be constant. In other words, you can't just plug a variable lambda into the answer equation. So what does one mean by a variable lambda? And within the context of a Friedman FRW type geometry, you can give it a meaning. And that's what this model is based on. But that has presumed the spatial homogeneity. I don't know how far you were working on some way of going beyond that and allowing for some spatial homogeneity.
So there was some code that I didn't get much beyond that.
So, I mean, but it wasn't yet a fully, it allowed for some conformal freedom or something.
Right.
It didn't allow for
it
arbitrary.
It made the scale factor function px and my homogeneity.
So that's the real issue. What's lacking is some. I mean, first you have the heuristic argument that tells you what the fluctuations would be. Then you're embedding that in some particular model that produces fluctuations of the required size. That's already an ansatz that's not as motivated as the first prediction. And then the next step would be, and that ansatz assumes spatial homogeneity. So the next step would be to come up with some more general realization of that that allowed general fluctuations of that give meaning to some sort of more general fluctuation. And there are technical problems or conceptual problems, I would say, with doing that that have not been solved yet.
For example, so this regarding this homogeneity issue, but different points in the CMB lattice scattering surface, they are causally disconnected if there is no inflation.
Yeah.
Right.
Of course, in this model, they're causally connected, but
they're causally connected.
Well, through the time, because they're all they all have the posters.
Yeah. Okay.
Through the plug here.
But they have the same sort of neighborhood.
Yeah, but
the same in inflation.
What?
The same in inflation scenario. They were really closely connected.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't stress this point because I don't think it's that big of a deal, but it is true that they're all causal.
Yeah, but my point is the volumes are different, except for that one post.
Yeah, or they have a few, have a few ancestors.
So then,
but the overlap of their past will be very small.
So, but the point is that since the volumes are different and they have a small overlap, then the lambdas would be different.
In this model, the most natural
then you have trouble with the CMB.
Yes, if you just naively said, if you just tried to naively generalize this kind of rule that was used to get a spatially dependent lambda, you would get way too large fluctuations in lambda. But you also don't know what it means. What does it mean to have a spatially varying lambda?
Yeah.